This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you listening. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Jason Croft, is at the controls this morning. In this hour of the show, we will be looking at the current state and talking a little bit about the future prospects for Medicare. And our guest is Dr. Christine Castle. She is a physician with more than 30 years' experience in caring for elderly patients. She is also the author of a recently published book that will help give some structure to the conversation here this morning. Her book is titled Medicare Matters. The subtitle is What Geriatric Medicine Can Teach American Healthcare. It is published by the University of California Press. It is certainly available now if you would like to look at it. Our guest, Christine Castle, currently serves as the president and CEO of the American Board of Internal Medicine, and she is joining us this morning by telephone. As we talk, questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Dr. Castle, hello.
Hello, David.
Thanks for talking with us today.
It's a pleasure.
We appreciate it. Just for a moment, because I think people might be interested about the American Board of Internal Medicine. This is the organization that when you hear a physician is board certified, you are the folks that do the certification.
We're the ones who do that. That's right. For internal medicine, which is only one of 24 recognized specialties that provide board certification, but we are by far the largest. We provide about 40. It's about 40% of the physicians who are board certified in the United States. It's general internal medicine and then 15 different subspecialties of internal medicine, such as cardiology, gastroenterology, critical care, and importantly, geriatric medicine.
Mm-hmm. And the certification process involves basically taking an exam?
Yeah. It has historically, for the 70 years we've been in existence, has involved an exam of knowledge to make sure that physicians are up to date and current with medical knowledge. But now it has developed into a much more comprehensive process, which also involves reviewing actual outpatient outcomes and performance assessment of the physician's practice.
So it's more than just a test of their knowledge.
So it's more than just knowledge. The way we talk about it is that knowledge matters, but it's not the whole story.
Right.
And that is actually part of what I talk about in my book, is that the ability actually to get real data about how physicians are actually performing in their practice is one of the things that allows us to measure quality of care and to be able to hold healthcare institutions, hospitals, and individual physicians more accountable to the public for the quality of care that they're delivering.
Let me ask you about a basic idea here that you discuss in the book. That is that, and it has to do with the very title of the book and the issue. Obviously, Medicare matters because it is the program that provides health care to a great many older Americans. And we certainly expect that in the future, as the proportion of the population that's in the older age range grows, that it will provide care to even more people. So it's certainly very important. But you're also making this argument that says if you look at the way that geriatric medicine is provided or perhaps should be provided, and
right,
if you look at how Medicare functions, that there are things that could be learned and that could be applied to providing health care to everyone, to people of all ages, not just to seniors.
That's right. And that's why Medicare matters. Medicare matters because it is our insurance system, really, not for providing care, but for paying for care for 35 and a growing number of millions of people over the age of 65 and a large number of disabled people as well. But because it is, in the United States, the most successful model for how to provide comprehensive care over a large population of people, that could help us understand how to get to the ultimate goal of providing insurance for everyone. But that said, the current Medicare model really has grown out of its historic roots starting in 1965, when medical care was very different. And the structure of the Medicare program really hasn't kept pace with our modern understanding of how to provide care, particularly for people with complex multiple chronic illnesses, such as elderly patients. Mm-hmm. And so Medicare needs to modernize. And my fear is that as we look at its shortcomings, and particularly the rising costs, there are people who say, well, Medicare is just hopelessly broken. Let's get rid of it, turn it all over to private insurance companies. And that, to my mind, that would be a great tragedy because it would be throwing the baby out with the bathwater. So I think Medicare matters too much to do that, to throw it out. I think we need to fix it.
You begin with a discussion of the field of geriatric medicine, which as a specialty is relatively young.
Yes.
in medicine, and make the argument that we have learned a lot and we continue to learn a lot about providing care and doing what we can to make sure that people in their older years are as healthy as they possibly can be, as high functioning as they possibly can be, and that what we really need to do is to apply the state-of-the-art geriatric medicine, what we know from that kind of practice, to taking care of all seniors. Having said all that, I'd like to have you talk a little bit about geriatric medicine. And are there some particular things that you think that we know now about taking care of older people that in the past we didn't know?
Oh, absolutely. First, I think it's important, and your listeners will probably be either surprised or entertained by this observation, that while geriatric medicine is a relatively new specialty in the United States, that isn't true in other countries. As a matter of fact, in Europe and in the United Kingdom, geriatric medicine began in the early part of the 20th century in many countries in Europe and was created as an official specialty in England just after World War II, as countries that have a more organized approach to healthcare sort of looked at the population dynamics, saw that people were living longer, and said, hey, we need a specialty of medicine to deal with aging, and they created this field of geriatric medicine. It wasn't until the early 1980s that the United States, I think kind of the Pepsi generation mentality, that we just didn't want to face aging and we didn't really sort of want to acknowledge that that as we age we need different approaches to medical care. So it took longer for us to do that. We learned a lot of lessons, I think, from other countries which had created this specialty. And it wasn't until 1988 that the American Board of Internal Medicine created a board-certified status for geriatric medicine in the United States. So it's fairly early here, but the observations about what's needed are really embedded in both evidence that you can improve outcomes for older people and different approaches to care. There are two aspects. Now, that said, there are two aspects of what it is that we've learned over these years. One of them, it has to do with the science of aging, that aging itself, that is to say, everything from how our cells, how the DNA and the genetics of cells functions, and the links of the aging of the basic biological systems in our bodies relates to diseases that seem to be more common with aging, everything from Alzheimer's disease to cancer to macular degeneration of the eyes. All of those are conditions, and there are many others, that are directly linked to this kind of genetic process of aging. And the more we learn about that, the more we can learn about how to prevent or delay or hopefully treat these kinds of conditions. But the other thing is that as more and more people have lived into old age and modern medicine has advanced both medical and surgical treatments, we've also learned through clinical research how some medications, for example, have worse side effects in older people. how some surgeries need to be done in a different way in a 90-year-old than they do in a 50-year-old. Different anesthetic agents may need to be used. Different recovery strategies need to be used for patients in the hospital when they have an illness if they're very old. So those are kinds of things that we didn't know even 20 or 30 years ago that because of research we now understand better.
Mm-hmm. Given the fact that geriatric medicine is relatively recent as a specialty, and I don't know how many physicians there are in the country that have that as their specialty, I am guessing that there are still the bulk of the care to older folks gets delivered by physicians that are more conventionally trained in internal medicine or their family practice doctors or whatever. Is overall, does that mean that somehow the quality of care that's delivered is not quite as good as we would like, or maybe that the outcomes are not quite as good as we would like because all physicians that are dealing with older patients maybe aren't operating at state-of-the-art level?
Well, unfortunately, I think the answer to your question is yes, although it doesn't mean that somebody has to be a board-certified geriatrician in order to provide good care to older people. As the field first developed in the early 1980s, it was internal medicine and also, by the way, family medicine and psychiatry who developed these subspecialty training programs, so areas where there were important needs. In every case, it's been very small numbers of physicians who've gone into it because the reimbursement is a very negative incentive, and I want to get back to that later in our conversation because I think that's part of how Medicare needs to be fixed. But people who do geriatric medicine are very disadvantaged by the current Medicare payment system. So you have to, you know, you're not in it for the money. You do it because you really get rewarded by it, by your personal rewards of taking good care of patients and the gratefulness of them and their families. And the intention, I think, never was that every older person, every person over the age of 65 or 75 needs to be taken care of by a geriatrician. There would never be enough doctors for that. But that all of us who are experts contribute to the education of every other specialty. When you think about it, every specialist, with the exception of pediatricians, needs to know more about aging, know more about caring for elderly people. Surgeons, anesthesiologists, psychiatrists, rehabilitation doctors, all of them need to have a better understanding of the principles of aging and the principles of geriatric medicine. That has started to happen. So I think that there are physicians who don't have boards in geriatrics, but who have in their medical school and in their training been exposed to some of these principles and have incorporated them in their practice. And so hopefully that will happen more and more.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess here again, the bottom line, and I'm assuming you would agree with the statement that if somehow we could apply better, more broadly, what we have learned about the aging process and delivering care to people in the older age categories, that perhaps for more older Americans, their quality of life could be better. And one of the things that maybe one would hope is that the need to provide custodial care, you know, non-skilled care
right,
for people in sheltered environments might not be. We know that that's always going to be there and that it's going to increase as the percentage of older people in the population increases. So there's sort of no getting away from that.
That's right.
But it's a huge issue. It's very expensive. And I guess anything that we could do to cut down on how much of that kind of care we would have to deliver would be a good thing. And if we could keep people healthier longer, that maybe then people would spend at the end of their life less time in a nursing home that
right,
somebody's going to have to pay for.
Well, and not only is somebody going to have to pay for it, but it's probably the single most dreaded outcome for all of us,
yeah, exactly,
as we face our own aging and our families. You know, I mean, how many times have you heard people say, you know, just whatever happens, don't put me in a nursing home. Now, I think we can learn from other countries that nursing homes don't have to be such a dreaded fate, and that they, if they are held to higher standards of quality, even people who are extremely disabled and who really don't need active medical care but do need, as you say, custodial care, which is really long-term care, can get the care they need in a way that's humane and dignified, and where families who are visiting them don't have to feel guilty that they've abandoned them. But that said, it is also expensive. So we do need to upgrade those facilities, but it also is costly, and you would like to avoid that as much as possible. There is actually a phrase for what you're describing that's called compression of morbidity, which is that if we can delay the onset of really serious disability until later in life, then the period between disability and dying will be less. And therefore, that period of disability will be shorter and people's meaningful life will be extended. The other part of that equation, of course, is being able to accept death, being able to accept the fact that there is an end to each of our lives, and that that needs to be accepted and humanely cared for as well, so that we don't have people facing the end of life with unnecessary medical intervention, which is both painful and unpleasant, but also and undignified, but also adds to the cost.
Yeah, that gets us into another issue of the cost,
right,
at end of life care. We'll hold that one for
a bit. Hold that one,
because,
okay.
Because we do have a caller, and I would like to also invite other people who are listening to call and to introduce again the guest. We're talking with Dr. Christine Castle. She is a physician with a lot of experience in providing care for older people. She's currently the president and CEO of the American Board of Internal Medicine and is the author of the book Medicare Matters, What Geriatric Medicine Can Teach American Healthcare, published by the University of California Press. Phone lines are certainly open, and if somebody would like to call in with a question, you may do that. 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana, toll-free, 800-222-9455. We do have a caller here locally in Champaign, line number one. Hello.
Yeah, just not to focus on this first one, but just a comment, and then I have a couple other ones. One is that as a nation, we really have not done a very good job on preventive care. It's an issue, but actually more focusing on Medicare. The current ruling in terms of a physical, one physical exam at the beginning of Medicare, and not having this included in Medicare, it just doesn't make sense to me. And then the next one is, I'll just comment and then let you comment offline.
Sure.
And the other one is in our current prescription program, Part D, I think is a real joke. It's very inadequate. People are going to see the problems with it. Could have been a much better solution. So I'll just go off the air, and you can comment on the West too.
Okay. Well, I'm sure that you would, quickly dispatch the first point, I'm sure that you would agree exactly with the caller said, that if we put more emphasis along the life course on prevention and keeping people healthy, then by the time that they got to be 70 or 80 or 90, you know, however they were long fortunate enough to live to, that they would be in better health. They wouldn't have as many problems. Their quality of life would be better. The cost of care would be less, you know, so you really can't argue with that idea.
Well, David, and if you don't mind, even though the caller asked me not to address that issue, I'd like to say a brief word about it.
Oh, please. No, yeah, go ahead.
It is so important, and I'm really glad that it was raised. And that's why in my book I have a chapter called Why 65, which is, so we have universal health insurance for everybody in the United States, but only if they make it to 65. Mm-hmm. And in fact, between the age of probably around 50 to 65 is a time when major issues of prevention are really important if one is going to go into those later years in a healthier status. That's when you start to need to get regular colonoscopy and mammography and other kinds of preventive tests. It's when, if you're overweight, you need to finally get serious about that. You need to throughout your life, do more exercise, but also get medical care. For people are much more likely to have the beginnings of heart disease if you're genetically susceptible to that. High blood pressure and diabetes are all things that are likely to start in that middle age time. And if you don't get good treatment for them in those years, by the time you get to Medicare, you're going to be in much worse shape. So I think that in fact, this issue of prevention gets to part of my concern that we actually extend the coverage from Medicare into the rest of the population.
Right.
So I just wanted to make that point. Now, the other two issues that were raised, the issue of the annual physical, this was a way of sort of allowing some little principles of what I think of as good managed care to enter into Medicare. And, you know, we had this big backlash against managed care about 10 years ago when there was a lot of, frankly, bad managed care around. But managed care is actually a good thing in geriatric care, and what it really does is provide a comprehensive, coordinated approach to what your healthcare needs are. And one of the things you need in order to be able to do that is what we call in geriatrics a geriatric assessment, but many other people think of it as an annual physical. And that is a comprehensive look of all of your healthcare issues by a physician and other members of the healthcare team to really plan for what your needs are. Now, if somebody's reasonably healthy, it doesn't have to take very long or involve very much. But for an older person who may have 6 or 8 different chronic conditions, be taking 10 or 12 different medications, it can be a really life-saving look at all of those issues. If it doesn't happen, then here you are going separately and independently to 6 or 8 different specialists for all of your different conditions. Nobody knows the medications the other one is giving you. Nobody's looking at the big picture. And the big picture is what makes geriatric medicine so much more effective, so that you avoid all of those either gaps in care or interactions and unnecessary care. So I think what Medicare has tried to do, though, is to contain the costs. And the costs of Medicare are going up and up and up. And there's a lot of reasons for that I talk about in my book. And so Congress is basically legislating specific benefits, benefit by benefit, to say, now, can we afford this one? Can we afford that one? That's not a good way to run a healthcare system. Congress is not trained in medicine. They're, you know, they're politicians and they're developing policies. They really ought to be able to create a program where the physician and the healthcare team could really decide what each patient needs and tailor care independently. But until we get more flexibility into the Medicare system, that's unfortunately what it is. And the last thing I'll say about that is that the annual physical is part of what is provided by either primary care physicians or geriatricians is very undervalued. You get paid much less for that than you do for getting a X-ray or a CAT scan or any kind of procedure. And so physicians are much more likely to go straight for the procedure because they're trained to do that and they get paid more than they are to be the primary care physician who's there spending time really looking through all your records and going through the whole big picture.
Yeah. I have a couple of other callers. I tell you what,
sure.
I want to also come back to the question of the prescription drug program.
Well, I'm sure that will come up.
But yes, if somebody doesn't raise it, we'll get back to it. But I think rather than make these folks wait, let's take some more calls. And we have somebody here on a cell phone calling from Mansfield. So they're next, line 4. Hello.
Yeah, hi. David, can you hear me okay?
Yeah, just fine.
Yeah, good. I'm calling from a cell, so I just have a couple of quick comments. I'll go ahead and ring off and let your guest comment. I'm actually employed by a company that services nursing homes, and so I travel quite a bit visiting nursing homes all throughout the state. What I've noticed, what we're noticing as a trend, is the acuity level of the residents in nursing homes. In other words, the people are coming to nursing homes a heck of a lot sicker than they were even 10, 15 years ago. And then the other thing, as far as the industry itself, the not so much for the docs, but the administrators, the DONs, the ADONs, there's a huge turnover in the industry.
That means director of nursing for your.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm using short term here.
Right.
Short end. I feel terrible because, it's a very hard job, but I feel bad for the residents because of the turnover. There's a lack of stability. And then my other quick point, my other quick observation. It's a cultural one where I was wondering if you guys could comment. Obviously, in this country, the feeling I get is really these people are warehoused in these institutions because we don't have the extended family perhaps as they did or they still do in Japan. And I think the horse has left that barn. I don't see us going back there as a country. But I'm wondering if that, in fact, would not add to the quality of life for some of these individuals instead of being warehoused, if you will, in these institutions, if they were taken in by family members, either because it's inconvenient or what have you. So I was wondering what all those observations, I'll go ahead and ring off and let you comment. Thank you.
Okay.
Great. Those are very good points. It's absolutely true that the acuity level has increased, that patients are sicker in nursing homes, in part because hospitals get rewarded for discharging people quickly, and that may not be a bad thing because acute care hospitals are not a great place for older people to be, and you're susceptible to hospital infections and other kinds of problems. But the problem is that the nursing home on the other end often is not as equipped as it should be to take care of this, what we call subacute or post-acute care. One of the reasons for that is that we pay for long-term care differently than we pay for acute care. Medicare will pay for a hospital. It will pay only briefly for a post-acute care. And then after that, you're either on your own, out of pocket, or on Medicaid. And since very few families can really afford that out-of-pocket cost for very long, long-term care is now takes almost half of most states' Medicaid budget, which is an amazing thing. One of the reasons why states are having more and more trouble using Medicaid to take care of poor people and the other people who need it. So this is a financing problem that really has to be solved. It also leads to a lot of inefficiencies and I think probably unnecessary expenses because the hospital isn't responsible for what happens when you go to the nursing home, and the nursing home isn't responsible for what happens when you go to the hospital. So the patients can get transferred back and forth, and nobody is really coordinating the care. So that, I think, is a big and important issue. About the question of different cultures, I'm really glad that the caller brought that up, because I think Americans could benefit, since we are a melting pot of a lot of different cultures, we could actually benefit from looking at models from other countries. Japan actually has a model where people stay in the home more, but you don't have as many women in the workplace in Japan. And so it's the woman who has to take care of grandma, whether it's your mother or your husband's mother. And we have to ask how many American women are going to be able to do that. Maybe if we had more support through insurance mechanisms for home care support, we could provide ways to do that. And there are some demonstration models which I think try to do that. But the other thing to do is to look across the world at a very different country, Sweden, where almost all the women are in the workforce. They pay very high taxes, but they have publicly financed very high-quality long-term care. And so the old people don't feel like they're warehoused. They get good care, and the family can go and visit them, provide the emotional support, but they don't have to be changing the wet sheets all the time. So there's just two very different cultures that have very different economic arrangements, and I think we in the United States are going to have to come up with perhaps a mixture of our own solutions.
Let's take another caller. This is line one, someone also on a cell phone. Hello.
Yes, I wanted to mention that there is in our culture, there's a real problem with compliance on medicines. And we have somewhere in the range of 70 million people with hypertension. only half of the people are taking medicine. And today we have a lot of generics that will fit several classes of medicines that can be used to lower this blood pressure. And it'll be several generics with cholesterol medicines now that can be used to stop a lot of this progression of our leading disease, which is heart disease. But one of the things that we have to, I think, change is the attitude of the American public about taking medicine.
Yeah.
And I was talking to someone in Spain. It was a Turkish physician, and she was a nephrologist. And I said, well, I'll bet you're busy. And she says, you know, I'm really not, because in Turkey, when they have hypertension, maybe that isn't the right word we should be using. We should probably use something else that sounds a little more forbidding. But she says people just get hysterical and take and do whatever is needed to rectify the situation. Well, in this country, obviously, we're not doing that very successfully. So I think if we took a program, and as far as paying for some of these things, is that since Americans are 60% overweight, maybe we ought to have a tax on restaurant food, which doesn't usually follow the dietary situations here, but we need some way of altering people's behavior, and if they're not going to be altered, at least they have to pay a tax so they can reimburse our nursing homes and other means of accommodation. But these, I was interested in your ideas about this. Thank you.
All right. Well.
Well, thank you. I don't know about a tax on food, but it certainly is true that Americans are more overweight than almost any other developed nation, and we really do, as a nation, have to deal with this, because it's going to mean that as all of us get older, it adds to the medical burden of old age, diabetes, osteoarthritis, hypertension, as you point out, et cetera. So you're absolutely right about that, and I think it's a very important public health issue. And, you know, medical care can help with that. The issue of compliance with medications has been complicated in the United States by the fact that until a year ago, Medicare didn't cover outpatient medications. And so unless you had supplemental insurance, you had to pay out of pocket for these. And so the new Medicare Part D benefit in some ways has begun to address that, although as the previous caller pointed out, it's a program that is far from ideal and has lots of problems with it. One of the problems is that people don't aren't incented to take generics, and we all have this barrage of advertising from drug companies about the latest and greatest new medication, and so consumers, especially informed consumers who pay attention, think, oh, well, I need to get this medication because the ads all say that it's the greatest thing since sliced bread, and so it makes it very hard for the physician to say, no, actually, this is a better drug for you, and besides, it doesn't cost as much. So we're kind of fighting that commercial advertising environment, and this is the same physician who, I would remind you, is not getting paid very much for all of the time they're spending having these long discussions with you about what are the pros and cons of these different medications. So we really do, we could, in fact, get a lot more medication, appropriate, effective medication to a lot more people if we were to use more generic drugs. You're absolutely right about that.
Let's talk about the prescription drug benefit, which was passed to great fanfare by the Congress after Mr. Bush, the president, saying that that was one of the things that he wanted to do.
Right.
It seemed like almost immediately there was controversy about this program, about whether or not the Congress was misled about what it would cost. There were right away there were complaints or concerns about the program being confusing and people having a hard time figuring out which of the best plans to go with. There was questions raised about the fact that private insurers were doing this and the government was not doing this. And looming over all of this is the continuing question of the increasing cost of medicines.
Right.
Just recently, there was a report that came out within about the last week or so, finding that in the first quarter of this year, the prices of the most widely used prescription drugs rose 3.9%. That's four times the general inflation rate. And
right.
So there are questions about the program with all of its limitations, whether or not, in fact, it's sustainable given the cost of medication.
And I'm glad you pointed out that recent report, David, because the answer is it's not sustainable. And unfortunately, I'm afraid, I don't want to be cynical, but I'm afraid that many of the Washington policymakers knew very well that it wasn't sustainable when they put it in place, but didn't have the stomach to fight the political battles with the very well-funded interest groups who wanted to get their piece of a very big pie. And that includes, it's not limited to the pharmaceutical companies, but certainly includes them. And so then when you find out that they raised the prices of the drugs just after they got Congress to pass a bill forbidding Medicare from negotiating lower prices based on volume, you have to think, wait a minute, you know, we just haven't got it right. So here's what I want to say about that. I think that Congress was misled. I think we had some pretty good evidence from actuaries within Medicare that they didn't want to hear the news about how much it was actually going to cost based on the structure of the Medicare Part D benefit. It's now, I think, double what Congress thought they were getting into at a time when our nation is facing huge deficits going forward and no sense of how we're going to deal with that. So I think that whoever the next administration after this one is, that they're going to be faced with some very tough and difficult choices because of this bill.
Mm-hmm.
Now, many people who didn't favor the specific provisions of it did actually support it, like AARP, because I think they felt we have to get a foot in the door. Medicare really does need to have prescription drugs. We have been saying this for 20 years, and here's a chance to finally get it, and we'll fix it afterwards. And so I think that's where we are now. We have to figure out a way to fix it afterwards. But meanwhile, it is true that millions of people have signed up. Millions of people now have medication coverage who didn't have it before. And, you know, in general, that's a good thing. Unfortunately, since ultimately it's not sustainable, what they're going to find is that the rules are going to change and it's going to be difficult, I think, going forward. They're going to face this donut hole this year, many of them, when suddenly the coverage stops until you get up to a $3,500 level and then starts again. And many of them didn't really understand that. And you can understand that because it doesn't make much sense. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is that the private plans, this really was a result of a big ideological debate about whether the government should be providing health insurance or whether it should all be commercial for-profit companies. And what this benefit did was to say we want the marketplace, we want the private companies to provide this benefit and not government-funded approaches. But they knew from past experience that they couldn't get the private companies to do it because, in fact, Medicare patients, many of them are poor risk and can cost more money. So what they did was they actually created a subsidy for private plans. So if you stay on regular Medicare, you pay a certain amount. Medicare pays a certain amount. But if you go to a private plan, they get 10% more. And so I thought this was supposed to be more efficient. So why are we paying more for it? Now, clearly, that's not sustainable. So what that means is that, and everybody is anticipating this, that all of that extra money that got thrown in to attract private industry is going to be rolled back. And my guess is it's going to be rolled back probably in the next Congress. Certainly, the physician payments are. And so what we're looking at is whether those companies are going to stay in the game when they're not making that extra money, and when sicker patients have greater needs. So I think there's a lot of challenges as we go ahead, and I hope that patient advocates and patients and families themselves really pay attention and raise these issues with the candidates who are running for election in Congress, because I think we're going to need to see some changes in you know, we want to make them in the right direction.
Let me again introduce the guest for this hour of the program. We're talking with Dr. Christine Castle. She is a physician who specializes in the area of geriatric medicine. She's also president and CEO of the American Board of Internal Medicine and author of a recent book entitled Medicare Matters, What Geriatric Medicine Can Teach American Healthcare. It's published by the University of California Press. We have about 10 minutes left, and we have here some callers, and we'll try to get all of them in the time that remains. And I think we're going to be going next to someone in Urbana. That's line number two. Hello.
Yeah, I clipped a article that came out earlier this year, which was co-authored by a University of Illinois Chicago professor of epidemiology, Olshansky, called The Longevity Dividend. And in that he... They're emphasizing the economic benefits of doing more research in geriatric issues, and they claim that there's reason to believe that there'd be a lot of economic benefit other than the insurance and tax aspects you were talking about. People would stay in the labor force longer, personal mm-hmm. incomes would increase, etc. But I was just wondering, they at least what I've seen out of this article, they don't cite any kind of research that would back up that assertion. And I was just wondering if in Europe or anywhere else there's any proof that when you extend the vital years, that the economy benefits.
Well,
I'll hang up then.
Yeah, it's a very good question. I'm actually know Professor Olshansky, and I'm familiar with his work, and he is a very excellent demographer and analyst, but who does come up with interesting and provocative studies. These are modeling studies, though. You're absolutely right. They aren't empirical studies that compare one country to another, let's say. But I think it's reasonable to assume that if people stay active and contribute to the economy, that could be a positive economic stimulus in a nation that isn't at full employment. And so that's always the, you know, the caveat in there. If you have high unemployment and not enough jobs, then having more older people, however active and capable they are, isn't necessarily going to help that. But our country, at least right now, there's plenty of potential for older people. I think what has to change, though, is attitudes in the workforce and what has been called ageism, negative attitudes about people just simply because of their age, not because of their capability. In some high-functioning organizations, people are realizing that older people bring experience and judgment, and you're seeing some trends in the opposite direction, but I think not nearly enough. The United States is the place where we're going to see whether this works or not, however, because the other countries all have much more substantial pension benefits, and we don't. And we have increasingly, especially over the last decade, seen pension benefits declining and eroding. So lots of older people are actually going to have to stay at work, which may actually be better for their health, maybe better for the economy, but isn't going to be so much of an option, I think, as it is in some other nations. And so I think we'll start to see whether that'll work or not. But I'm afraid I can't tell you point to any other country that really demonstrates that phenomenon.
All right. Let's go to another caller here. And this is, let me see, Urbana Line 3. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes. There was a study that came up recently that I think bears on your earlier discussion of the cost of medications. And the study announced that drug companies were spending twice as much on consumer advertising than they were on the development of new drugs and research in general. What is the necessity of consumer advertising for many years, I believe it was prohibited, and I think
that's
it still is in many countries.
That's right. Well, and I appreciate that point. I think it's, and it relates to our earlier discussion. In fact, the pharmaceutical industry spends an enormous amount in advertising in general, advertising to physicians as well as advertising to consumers, and more of it is to consumers because, in fact, that is working in the way that I described earlier. And it was prohibited until about 10 years ago and is prohibited in many other countries precisely because people are misled often about the benefits of particular medications. And in other countries, particularly where you have more government oversight of how healthcare resources are used to be able to cover the whole population, there's a real concern about having the most cost-effective medications be used. Many of those countries, I would also point out, are countries that negotiate lower prices with the very same drug companies that the United States Medicare is prohibited from doing the same thing with. So Canada, many European countries, they all buy the same medications from the same companies, but are able to negotiate discounts because they get such large volumes for them. And then they depend on the physicians and nurses to make recommendations about what's the best medication. Now, I just want to make one other point, though, about that, which is that I'm all in favor of consumers being better informed about their health care and making decisions collaboratively with their clinical providers, their doctors, and their nurses. So I don't want to give the idea that the doctor in a vacuum makes these decisions. But I do think when the doctor is kind of fighting uphill against misconceptions that are fostered by advertising, then it just makes that job much tougher.
Thank you for your comment.
All right, thanks for the call. Before we get to the end here, I want to raise a question about the future and where we're heading. And we're concerned about the increasing costs. We know that the number of people in the older age categories will increase, so we can expect the people who will need services will increase. We've talked about the cost of the increase of prescription medication. All of that leads to this question about how in the world we're going to pay for this. Is it inevitable that we're going to have to make some decisions and say to some people that, and not just to some people, say to everybody that we're simply not going to be able to give everybody as much care as maybe they think they should have? I mean, do we really, I hate to use the word rationing, but you do in the book. Are we really going to get to that point where we're going to have to say it's simply not sustainable, and we're going to have to rein in what kind of care is provided, particularly at the end when most of the money is spent?
Well, David, I'm glad you raised that because I do quite intentionally in the book use that dreaded R word, rationing. It's a word that has been used as a slogan in many political campaigns, and it really scares people off. But let's remember the roots of it are rational. That is to say, a rational approach to how we spend our money on healthcare. And I think if we are going to have the people who really can benefit from what modern medicine and modern geriatric medicine have to offer in improving our lives as we get older, then we're going to have to take seriously a more rational approach to how we decide what we pay for and, frankly, what we don't pay for. Now, part of this doesn't have to mean that somebody is denied something that they could really benefit from. Let me remind you that we already ration care in this country. We ration it based on whether you can pay for it or not. And, you know, maybe there's a better way to do it. Maybe we should ration it by whether it actually works or not. There's a lot of health care that is provided in the United States that is wasteful, redundant, and unnecessary. And this is very well documented by the Institute of Medicine reports on quality of care that have come out over the last 10 years. And so we now know that our system stimulates unnecessary utilization. Some of it comes from this direct-to-consumer advertising. Some of it comes from the fact that we overpay for certain kinds of procedures, and we don't have any process that says, well, let's use this X-ray technique rather than that one. Instead, what we do is we do both, because the insurance companies will pay for both. But nobody will pay for the person who says, you know, you don't need that one. You only need this one. And so that's what I mean by good managed care. And some of the experts in quality of care think that if we actually reduce all the waste and unnecessary care, that we wouldn't need to restrict anything that could benefit people, but we would then have a more rational approach. I don't know whether that's the case or not, but I certainly know that we have a lot of extra spending that we do in our system that could be cut back before we start really rationing things that people might consider necessary.
We'll have to stop there and thank our guest, Dr. Christine Castle, President and CEO of the American Board of Internal Medicine, author of Medicare Matters, What Geriatric Medicine Can Teach American Healthcare, published by the University of California Press. Dr. Castle, thank you very much.
Thank you, David. It's been a pleasure talking with you and your listeners.